Chapter 2. Think for yourself. From passive to active player in your own life. When I sit across from my clients, my starting point is that I must encourage them to think for themselves. They must learn to reflect over their own choices and values. And they must use their own creativity, because life demands of us that we are creative. Creativity is an optimal opportunity to use your knowledge, and we are better off in life with a brain that is used to thinking in creative solutions. Albert Einstein must have at some point said, "The true sign of intelligence is not knowledge, but imagination." Because you first and foremost must be able to imagine that something can exist before you can develop it. The vast majority of people have a great potential to be creative, if creativity is seen as an optimal opportunity to use knowledge. And knowledge is most certainly a key concept. Let us take an example from the art world. Picasso is most known for his abstract works from the Cubist period. But before Picasso could even break out of the painterly tradition of the time, he studied the anatomy of the body. He could draw a human body to perfection before he began to create his abstract paintings, in which all the rules and knowledge about anatomy were dissolved. His works did not just appear out of nowhere. There were many years of training, exercises, and knowledge behind them. Asking children to be creative is often an impossible project for them if they have not acquired some basic skills. The same applies to adults when we have to think of creative solutions. Being creative requires that our brains are prepared for it. This capacity is not just reserved for artists like Picasso. We all can learn. Creativity is much more than being able to paint and play an instrument. It is being able to find new solutions and being adaptable and flexible. We must be able to change our track if a particular strategy is not working or is having a negative effect. But to break out of a framework, we need to know it. And to break some of the psychological rules that we have created for ourselves and which are not especially suitable, we need to be able to recognize them. This is what you do in therapy. The therapist shows which unsuitable strategies and frameworks the client has created. Then you look at how the client can be creative, do something else, and break out of the box. The now deceased American psychiatrist and psychotherapist William Glasser is one of the key figures in a series of therapeutic recordings that were completed at Lehigh University, Pennsylvania, in 1996. The situation is contrived, and the client is an actor. But Glasser's message to the client is both very telling and applicable. The client wants to talk about the relationship with her dying father, whom she has never been close to. Behind this, however, lies the client's failing relationship with her husband. Glasser says to her that he will not talk about her dying father, but that she ought to go home and do something about her marriage, since she is unhappy with the way things are. He encourages her to take responsibility and to be creative and take advantage of the opportunities life offers rather than using the relationship of her dying father as a cover for inaction. Many people lack the creativity to think and take responsibility for themselves. Courage is required to be creative and dare to take responsibility for new solutions, especially putting them into practice without knowing where they might take us. But if you put yourself in the driver's seat, life becomes more exciting and much easier to endure during difficult moments. Sometimes we must mobilize our courage to make a decision and put it into practice to see what happens. Otherwise, we get stuck. As a psychologist, I often hear the phrases, "I can't do that," or "You can't do that." My response is that the client should at least try to act. Also, see Glasser, 1997-1999. when we do not act. In order for metacognitive therapy to work, it is necessary to act on your own behalf. At one point, I had a client where the therapy did not succeed. The woman was 37 years old and told me that she had a debilitating anxiety that had begun some years before. Earlier in her life, she had been depressed and had been hospitalized, and now she had developed a kind of generalized anxiety with clear depressive traits. When I asked her what she had done about it, she replied that she had taken some medication based on her doctor's recommendation. I therefore asked her about what she thought about taking so much medication, but she did not have an opinion. If my doctor says that I have to take medication, I take it. She did nothing else to improve her condition, because she did not think that she could. At the time when the woman came to see me, she was on sick leave. She was married, and the couple had two small children. Although she thought that she ought to drop off and fetch the children, she did not do so, because she was afraid of having an anxiety attack at the daycare center. So it was her husband or the grandparents who dropped off and fetched them. They were also the ones who cooked, washed the dishes, bought the groceries, and dealt with the other chores. Most of the time, she lay in bed or on her couch. I asked her what she did about the thoughts that plagued her and whether lying on the couch made her feel better. She told me that she did not do anything specific with her thoughts, and she did not feel any better by lying down and staring into space. In fact, she just had more time to ruminate and worry. We completed a series of exercises, and I gave her homework so that there were clear agreements about what she had to do for our next meeting. But she never did the exercises. And each time she came to therapy, she reported that nothing worked. "You need to do something about it," she told me. But the problem was that she did not respect the agreements we made. Therefore, I asked her whether it was because she had forgotten to do her homework. If so, we could talk about making a plan to help her remember what we had talked about. But she refused. She did not think that she could cope with doing the exercises. Instead, she took more and more pills, became even more inactive, and got worse and worse. This example is extreme, but I include it here because it is a clear example that her environment, in this case her family, had taken all forms of responsibility away from her. This had made her a passive participant in her own life. After a while, she called me and told me she was not coming anymore because she was going to be admitted to a psychiatric ward. I told her that this might mean a psychiatrist could reduce her use of pills and that she might see it as an opportunity to be tapered off the medication. This example is without a happy ending and shows that the therapist cannot perform miracles if the client does not take part and choose to work with the tools the therapist has put at their disposal. I can introduce tools to the client and give her homework, but I cannot make decisions on her behalf. Passivity and overregulation. All too many people end up as bystanders in their own and others' lives. This book is not a political debate book. But I have to point out that a welfare society has a negative effect on certain areas of our lives, because there are so many things in life that are thoroughly regulated and overregulated, which we blindly accept. Your son should begin daycare when he is 2 years and 8 months old. But maybe he's too young when he's 2 years and 8 months old. Perhaps he needs a month or two more at the nursery before he can cope with the bigger children. He's not necessarily old enough to be able to live up to the demands of his environment. It is often not taken into account that children develop differently, and this is normal. For example, if you become ill as an adult and the employment center must be involved, you must go to interviews and tell them when you expect to be well. I get letters from GPs and from employment centres wanting to hear when my clients will be better. But I cannot answer this because none of us can follow a fixed schedule. The result of all this regulating may be that we as individuals do not develop our creativity and ability to think for ourselves because others do so for us. Just like the examples with the woman who let everyone else think for her and make decisions on her behalf. Following others blindly. Making a conscious choice is also about having the courage to make the choice that works for you, and especially asking the question, why? Many people come to blindly follow the norms of others, unwritten rules, or what the latest and most popular research tells them, without stopping to ask themselves questions like, why am I making these choices about my life? And why have I chosen to raise my children in this way? We should not be so afraid of not always following the guidelines that everyone else follows. And we should also dare to say that a study may show one result, but there may well be studies that show other results. But the research shows, I often hear course participants and clients say, when they have to make decisions for themselves or their children. But what research? Where has the research been conducted? In China? In an African country? In the USA? And how many have been involved in the research trial? Behind every research project are many considerations and decisions that help determine whether one field of research gets an injection of funding as opposed to another. The fact that research has been carried out in a field means, in the first instance, that there has been an interest in investing money in that field. Just because there's no research in a field, or no evidence that a procedure, a type of medicine, or a method works, does not mean that the method or medicine does not work. One example is the use of ginseng, which is widely used in Asia, as well as in Germany and Switzerland. Some people would argue that there is no evidence that ginseng works. But to me, there is enough evidence when a nation has been using it for thousands of years. That information means more to me than a study based on 300 people. In general, we humans often find what we are looking for. If we are looking for evidence that one form of therapy works better than another, these are often the results we will find. We need to grow accustomed to thinking more for ourselves and to making conscious choices that are not solely based on the most popular research, on rigid systems with no room for human beings, and on unwritten rules that nobody questions. Flexible conditions and space for human beings. The understanding of who we are and what our society is ought to be based on the fact that we are not the same. We do not have equal chances and opportunities, even though society tries to homogenize us with more and more rules about what we should be able to do at 3 years old, 5 years old, etc. We are different from the day we are born. Therefore, there must be a certain degree of flexibility in relation to each individual. And each person must also try to move beyond all the rules and systems. For example, being self-employed, I have to work more or less every day, including on the weekends, or when I'm on vacation. I need to check emails and stay updated. At one point, an acquaintance told me that I should not work when I'm on vacation. But how can an outsider know what is best for me? I like to be able to turn on the computer and work 2 or 3 hours if it fits into my daily rhythm when I'm on a vacation with my family. And then there are other days when I cannot be bothered to turn on the computer. It is not certain that I necessarily will deliver a good performance if I'm forced to produce something each day between 8 a.m. and 4 p.m. Maybe it will first be at 7 p.m. that I get a spark of inspiration and can deliver a good piece of work. The point is that there are so many rules, both unwritten and written, and so many expectations about how I and everyone else should live their lives that we easily risk losing the opportunity to judge for ourselves what is best for us, our families, and our working lives. Talking does not change lives. Action does. When clients come to me with a problem, I always ask what they have done to solve the problem. The answer is often that they have not really done anything, and I, as a psychologist, am the expert who should tell them what the solution is. Creative thinking is available to most of us. But creativity takes courage. To think for yourself takes courage. It takes courage to go against what people say is not possible, or to go against what our closest network holds on to. And then it takes action. An appointment with a psychologist will not change your life. On the contrary, the actions you take after the psychologist has given you the tools will. Ultimately, we have to be players in our own lives and think for ourselves. A client asked me at one point, "Where is the empathy in this kind of therapy?" My answer is that empathy lies in the method itself. I do not spend 2 or 3 sessions getting to know my client and pretending that I care about the client as though it was a personal matter. If I did, I would be turning my nose up at my professionalism. Instead, in the first session, I try to show the client what is going on in his head and how the exercises he takes home can help him get out of a difficult situation. Empathy lies in the fact that I give the client specific knowledge along with specific tools that can help reduce psychological pain from the very first session, and that I do not try, like in other forms of therapy, to dig into his past with the pain that this entails for the client. Empathy lies in the fact that I implicitly tell the client that he has his own resources and creativity, and that he can cope with coming out on the other side of his problem when he knows that there are other strategies he can use right away.